Welcome to Eco Radio KC. On tonight's program, Craig Lubow will speak with David Mitchell with 350.org, and he's also the interim director of Citizens Climate Lobby. First, a couple of news items. Scientists turn algae into crude oil in less than an hour. This is from Pacifica Northwest National Laboratory. Researchers at the U.S. Department of Energy's Pacifica Northwest National Laboratory in Richland, Washington, have discovered a way not only to replicate but speed up the cooking process to simulate crude oil to the point where a small mixture of algae and water can be turned into a kind of crude oil in less than an hour. Besides being readily able to be refined into more burnable gases like jet fuel, gasoline, or diesel, the proprietary technology also generates as a byproduct chemical elements and minerals that can be used to produce electricity, natural gas, and even fertilizer to perhaps grow even more algae. It could also help usher in algae as a viable alternative. An analysis has shown that implementing this technique on a wider scale may allow companies to sell biofuel commercially for as low as $2 a gallon. Also, Exxon to face criminal charges for 50,000 plus gallons of wastewater, of fracking wastewater spill. ExxonMobil's subsidiary XTO Energy will have to face criminal charges for allegedly dumping tens of thousands of gallons of fracking waste at a Marcellus shale drilling site in 2010, according to a Pennsylvania judge's ruling on Thursday. Following a preliminary hearing, Magisterial District Judge James G. Karn decided that all 8 charges against Exxon, including violations of both the state Clean Streams Law and the Solid Waste Management Act, will be held for court, meaning there is enough evidence to take the fossil fuel giant to trial over felony offenses. Pennsylvania Attorney General filed criminal charges back in September, claiming Exxon had removed a plug from a wastewater tank, leading to 57,000 gallons of contaminated water spilling into the soil. Fracking or hydraulic fracturing is a method of extracting fossil fuels that generally increases the flow of oil or gas from a well. It is done by injecting high-pressure water and chemicals miles deep into the ground into subsurface rock, effectively fracturing the rock and allowing more spaces for oil and gas to come through. The tactic is generally paired with horizontal drilling. Stay tuned to Eco Radio KC for more on that. And one other news item. Secretary of State John Kerry aggressively pursues major climate pact, could close door on Keystone XL pipeline. The tubes have been buzzing over a New York Times report on Secretary Kerry's aggressive pursuit of a new global climate agreement, which has some clear implications for approval of the controversial Keystone XL tar sands pipeline. In a nutshell, things ain't looking so good, and that has us wondering if the U.S. coal industry is also going to face some serious problems down the road. This is from EcoWatch. And so stay tuned for that. Coal is the canary in the coal mine, they're saying. And that's all the news we're going to have for tonight. I'm going to turn it over now to Craig Lubow. Craig?
Okay, thank you, Mike. And welcome, David.
Well, thank you.
Before we get into the topic of global warming, if you could just tell the listeners, what is 350.org and what is the Citizens Climate Lobby?
Well, 350.org was an organization that was established by Bill McKibben and 6 students of his at Middlebury College in Vermont several years ago. They have since expanded to basically an international organization with chapters all over the world. They engage in various public protests. They have a divestment campaign going on where they're trying to get various organizations to divest their funds from their investment funds from fossil fuel companies, pretty much as a tactic to strip away the social license of fossil fuel companies. They have a number of campaigns and activities that they do. But the name 350 means that they want to get carbon in the atmosphere down to 350 parts per million, which James Hansen says is the safe limit for the amount of CO2 in the atmosphere.
And now for the people who don't know who James Hansen is, tell us a little bit about him.
James Hansen was he's basically America's preeminent climatologist. He was with the Goddard, I think it's the Goddard Space Center, with NASA for quite a long period of time. He just retired recently. He has studied global warming for a very long time. He testified to Congress in 1988 about global warming and that it was going to be a problem. He wrote a book called Snores of My Grandchildren, where he tries to tell the public of the dangers of global warming. I'm not sure what else to say about him at this point.
Let's go back. What is the Citizens Climate Lobby?
The Citizens Climate Lobby is a group that was formed by a man named Marshall Saunders. And Marshall Saunders is a shopping center real estate developer. I'm not sure if it was in California or Colorado, but he became concerned about global warming in about 2005, and he started going around giving speeches on global warming, and he began to realize that people did not have any lever with those in power to express their concerns about global warming. So he founded Citizens Climate Lobby to empower people to advocate with members of Congress their position and their concerns about global warming. The beauty about Citizens Climate Lobby is that they have just one focus, and that is the passage of a national policy of carbon fee and dividend.
Okay. What does that mean by carbon fee and dividend?
Well, basically the fee is essentially a tax on fossil fuel corporations that they pay at the origin of either mining or drilling for their particular fossil fuel product. And they pay like a certain amount on each ton of CO2 emissions that they're going to produce by that product. The initial proposal by CCL is to levy $15 a ton the first year on oil, for example, and that would mean 15 cents extra on a gallon of gas, and then ramp it up gradually about $10 a ton over the next 10 years. And all of these funds, CCL advocates that all of these funds be transferred by the IRS back to American citizens so that they can afford the increased cost of living.
Okay. And if you do that, though, you're going to end up, the cost of gas is going up to account for that.
Yeah, the intent is to, there's two things. You know, one is to, the primary intent is to drive up the cost of fossil fuels so that you can open up the market for development of efficiencies and investment in renewable technologies.
And then if you're giving that back to as rebates or dividend to the consumer, mm-hmm. how does that, in the ultimate analysis, how does that help reduce the carbon?
Well, that's a good question. People who engage in low carbon lifestyles the way that it's supposed to work is that people that are efficient and engage in low carbon lifestyles will be able to save money from their rebate check, and but the general idea is to, as fossil fuels become more expensive, the natural tendency will be for society as a whole to look for efficiencies and look for new ways of doing things, and it would open up entrepreneurs for solar and wind and other things similar to that.
Let's address the global warming itself. To start with, tell us what exactly is global warming?
Well, it's pretty much self-explanatory. Humanity's been warming the planet through pumping of CO2 into the atmosphere since the beginning of the Industrial Revolution in 1750. And the vast majority of that CO2 has been pumped into the atmosphere probably in the last 50 to 60 years. The planet is warming. It's warming. I'm not sure whether I can put rapidly or gradually or not on that, but there are records being broken quite consistently, especially the last 3-4 years or so, and I think since 2010 in particular. Worldwide, I think, on the news there started being stories of very extreme weather events happening all over the world that were completely unheard of before.
And would that include, do they have reason to believe that the hurricanes on Sandy and before that Katrina, that was affected by global warming?
Well, global warming just loads the dice. You know, it loads the dice for extreme weather events. You know, it just makes extreme weather events more probable. I mean, you can't point to any particular event and say that global warming caused that. You know, but at least that's my understanding of things.
You know, we talked about the carbon as part of the global warming issue. Scientifically, how does the carbon warm the atmosphere? What's happening there?
Well, as we pump CO2 into the atmosphere through the burning of coal, oil, and natural gas, CO2, methane, and nitrous oxide, sunlight comes and hits the Earth and then is reflected back as infrared heat, and these greenhouse gases trap some of that heat and keep the Earth at a temperature that's fit for life.
Okay. And as you know, we're sitting here in today where we hit a record low or close to record low last night. So some people are going to ask, are we starting the ice age and do we really have global warming? So what do we respond to?
Well, you and I were talking about this on the way over here. I mean, I think, what I read today on the Internet was that this was the coldest weather in 20 years. But, I remember when when I was younger that, you know, winters in Missouri, you could pretty much count on at least a couple cold snaps per winter where temperatures would get below zero. And I would regard, and you know, we haven't had any cold weather like this in 20 years, which is quite a statement. You know, this is I would not regard this cold snap we're going through as anything more than natural variability. It's quite unusual. Actually, we haven't had a cold snap like this in 20 years.
All right. Now we need to take a break, and we will be back in just a minute.
Hi, I'm Priscilla Stuckey, author of Kissed by a Fox. Next time on New Dimensions, I'll be talking about exploring our relationship with the natural world.
New Dimensions airs at 5 a.m. on Tuesdays.
What's happening in Jackson County, you might ask? What's happening in Jackson County now? What might we see in the future? And just what does the Jackson County Legislature do? Scott Burnett is the first district Jackson County legislator. He was first elected in 1998, and he's been involved in politics and government for much of his professional life. And he's going to give us the State of the County address on the next All Souls Forum right here on KKFI, Wednesday at 6 p.m.
Okay, thank you. We are back. For those of you just joining us, we're with David Mitchell, and we are talking about global warming. We would talk about the cold snap, and I think when they measure global warming and the temperature of the Earth, they're not looking at one area, are they?
Well, no. I mean, you know, I think the reality is that 2012 in the United States was the hottest year on record in the contiguous 48 states. Worldwide, from 2000 to 2011, all 11 of those years were, I think 11 of the last 13 years have been the warmest in the modern record. Only 1998 was warmer than 2011. You know, I think the, global warming is proceeding by decade. You know, so you can, you have a certain amount of warming per decade, and it's continually going up. Bill McKibben in his article in Rolling Stone called global warming's terrifying new math. At the time that he wrote it was about July of 2012. He said in May of 2012 that was the 327th consecutive month that global temperature exceeded the 20th century average. He said the odds of that happening by chance are 3.7 times 10 to the 99th power. That's more than there are stars in the universe. So, in other words, we're warming up. So, I think that's very safe
to
say.
In fact, even while we're in the cold snap here, are there other areas of the planet that are having the opposite?
Well,
in terms of heat.
Yeah, I just recently read that Australia had their hottest year on record just in 2013, and that it was 1.2 degrees centigrade above their long-term temperature average. And their meteorological bureau of meteorology said all but one of the last 10 years have had warmer than average temperatures in Australia. And they also concluded that figures from the Bureau and other bureaus around the world provided a body of evidence that we're all seeing a warming Australia and a warming world. So,
okay. If we do nothing about global warming, if we maintain the status quo, what are the implications? What are the consequences of global warming other than just the temperature going up?
Well, I think you're talking about the business as usual scenario, and I think I can get to my notes here on the Union of Concerned Scientists and their listing of global warming effects. Uh-huh. And I think basically we'll just things are going to get pretty bad. to bring it down to the local level, if let's see, where are my notes here in Missouri? I'm losing my notes in Missouri here for the moment. Okay, basically, according to the Union of Concerned Scientists website, sea level rise is accelerating. The number of large wildfires is growing. Dangerous heat waves are becoming more common. Extreme storm events are increasing in many areas. There are more severe droughts. More severe droughts are occurring in other areas. These consequences will continue to intensify, grow ever more costly, and increasingly affect the entire planet, including you, your community, and your family. That's a quote off their website.
When you mentioned the economy, what effect will it have on the economy, or what do they think? And what about the food supply? What effect is it going to have on the food supply?
Well, there's going to be longer and more damaging wildfire seasons. There's going to be more frequent and intense heat waves that will definitely affect food production. There will be costly and growing health impacts, heavy precipitation and flooding, which will interfere with your food production. They do mention disruption to food supply. There is the potential. This is, Union of Concerned Scientists now. There is a potential to seriously disrupt our food supply, driving costs upward and affecting everything from coffee to cattle, from staple food crops to the garden in your backyard. That's also a quote. The seasons are changing. Spring is coming 10 days earlier. Plant and animal ranges are shifting. There is also the potential for abrupt climate change, where the climate will change within tens of years as opposed to thousands of years or millions of years. I think the each organization sort of lists different effects. For example, they all sort of form kind of a general agreement, but here, for example, let me get to my notes from NASA. Let's see here. According to NASA and their website, the article is Global Climate Change, How Do We Know? And then they list a number of things which are evidence of very rapid climate change. They say that sea level has risen 6.7 inches in the 20th century, and we are double that rate the first decade of this century. The Earth has warmed since 1880, with most of it coming since 1970. 20 of the warmest years since 1981 have occurred, 10 of the warmest in the last 12 years, despite a deep solar minimum in 2007 to 2009. The oceans are warming with a 0.302 degrees Fahrenheit increase in the top 2,300 feet. Greenland, there are shrinking ice sheets and shrinking glaciers all over the world. Greenland is currently losing 36 to 60 cubic miles of ice per year from 2002 to 2006. Antarctica had lost 36 cubic miles between 2002 and 2005. There is declining Arctic sea ice. The Arctic sea ice has essentially collapsed. There's only about 20% of sea ice left from the 1979 average.
In terms of the ice, is there something different happening in the southern hemisphere at the Antarctic pole? Because you had you had that expedition ship that was stranded in ice there.
Well, Antarctica is a continent which is covered with ice, and whereas the northern Arctic ice sheet is just an ocean covered with ice. You know, I think the amount of sea ice surrounding Antarctica is increasing, and I don't have the stat right here in front of me, but memory serves me that it is within 1-2% per decade or something like that. But it's losing land ice. Okay. It's losing, as I said, it's losing 36. Antarctica's lost 36 cubic miles between the years of ice between 2002 and 2005. And so that's not as bad as Greenland, but it's cubic mile of ice is quite a bit. So, but it's hard to imagine. I mean, I don't know how many cubic miles of ice there are in Antarctica, but so there's glacial retreat, there's extreme weather events, there's ocean acidification, which is an extremely serious issue, and the ocean is 30% more acidic than it was before the Industrial Revolution, and the problem with that is that small marine life that form shells have difficulty doing that, and there's a small creature called a pteropod that will start having difficulty forming its shell, and they're the favorite food of fish, so the food chain will start to be affected sooner or later.
Now, as far as the acidification of the ocean, how do we know whether that's due to the global warming or if it's due to dumping in toxic chemicals in the ocean?
Well, my understanding is that it's the CO2 mixing with the surface of the water, and the ocean has taken in a great deal of carbon from the beginning of the Industrial Revolution and continues to do so. I can't give an answer as opposed to toxic chemicals that we dump into the ocean. I'm not familiar with that, really.
Now, if you look over the past several million years, there's people out there, skeptics, are going to point to graphs showing that there have been periods of global warming before, that it's a cyclical thing. What's different about it this time, and what do we know that should make us alarmed about it, something now that maybe they weren't alarmed when it happened a thousand years ago?
Okay. Well, mainly, I think it's a... the drilling of, well, I have to find my notes here, but, you know, from memory, the drilling of ice cores from Antarctica and ice sheets in Greenland and tropical glaciers indicate that there have been seven glacial periods in the last 650,000 years or so. And but the CO2 kind of goes like a roller coaster from 180 parts per million to 280 parts per million, kind of like a sine wave. And in 1750, it was at 280. And we've taken that 280 in geological time, in the blink of an eye, we've run it up to 400, which is right about where we're at now. So it's the speed, it's the speed with which we are pumping carbon into the atmosphere. I think the... if I can find this particular article, there is a
So it's happening at a faster rate of speed than the previous cycles.
The issue is the speed with which it's happening, and the problem is that Lonnie Thompson is an American climatologist with Ohio State, and he says that there basically is an existential threat from global warming, and he says virtually all, and this is a quote from him, and he's internationally recognized, by the way. He says virtually all climate researchers are now convinced that global warming poses a clear and present danger to civilization. And then he goes on to say that there is a, quote, a real possibility that we will face the environmental, societal, economic consequences of climate change faster than we can adapt to them. And then he goes on to talk about our best hope is to slow the rate of global warming that we are doing, and mainly the pumping of burning of fossil fuels, thereby giving engineers and scientists time to devise, develop, and deploy technological solutions where possible. I think there was an article from that was cited by Joe Rahm in his blog Climate Progress, and let me see if I can find it here. He was citing a study that we were dumping carbon in the atmosphere 10 times faster than 10 times faster than the, I think it's the paleo Eocene thermal maximum, which was 55 million years ago, and that's regarded as an analog to this time, but I can't find it here right now. I got sorry.
We talked about another scientist, Mark Linus.
Mark Linus.
Right.
Yeah.
And you told me some information about him and the theory of wedges. So can you tell us about that?
Yeah. Well, basically, Mark Linus wrote a book called 6 Degrees. And basically, the whole book is he takes a chapter to describe a 1 degree centigrade warming world, a 2 degree centigrade warming world, all the way up to 6 degrees centigrade. And he basically takes the angle that he describes a kind of nightmare world beyond once you get up around 4, 5, and 6 degrees centigrade increase. He thinks that if we go, according to his research and review of the literature, that if we go over 2 degrees centigrade increase, that we will go into runaway global warming, that we will not be able to stop. So basically, at the end of the book, he talks about wedges, and he borrows that concept from these two guys at Princeton University. One is named Sokolow, and I think the other guy's name is Pakula. And Mark Linus says that in order to have a 75% chance of staying below 2 degrees centigrade, emissions must peak by 2015. And he's writing this book in about, I think he wrote this book in around 2007 or so. And so that was a little bit ago. So we're just 2 years away from 2015, and I'm not sure we're going to make peak by then. But and they must decline by 85% by 2050. And so basically he posits that humanity must invest in 11 to 12 wedges And a wedge is the saving of 1 billion tons of carbon annually by the year 2050. And so, you know, for example, you know, there's and a wedge is really each wedge is a massive undertaking. You know, for example, if you halt tropical deforestation along with massive reforestation by 2050, that would be one wedge, one of your 11 or 12. You know, if you have a 700-fold increase in solar power covering 5 million acres worldwide, that would be one wedge. Of course, he's writing this in 2007, so it's going to be a little bit off. He said if we build 2 million 1-megawatt turbines, wind turbines, and which will be equivalent to 3% of the U.S. land area, that would be one wedge. If you cut distances of driving, if you cut the distance of driving by the worldwide car fleet by one half, that would be one wedge. If you doubled the efficiency of the worldwide car fleet from 30 miles a gallon to 60 miles a gallon, that would be one wedge. He does talk about nuclear, and environmentalists really don't like this idea, but he talked about building 701 gigawatt nuclear power stations, which would be one wedge. And he also talked about carbon capture and storage, which is not a favorite method for environmentalists either.
That hasn't even been shown to work yet, has it?
Well, I think there are some power stations around the world that are kind of like demonstration, but they're expensive, and it would cost a lot of money. And I don't have a lot of familiarity with it, but the idea would be to inject it, you know, underground and or underneath the sea, and I just that whole idea makes me a little nervous, but. But, yeah, to do carbon capture and storage, you'd have to do it at 800 similar-sized coal plants for one wedge. So there is this article that Joe Rahm cited in Climate Progress. Joe Rahm is he's a climate blogger. He cited an article where which was asserting that we needed 19 wedges to be deployed over a 50-year period in order to make sure that we didn't heat up over 2 degrees centigrade, I believe. So,
there's also a book that we talked about before by Thomas Berry. Tell us about that one, what his theories are.
Yeah, Thomas Berry is... he wrote this book, and it was called The Dream of the Earth, and he wrote it in 1988. But it's just as relevant now as it was then. He basically talks about how here, let me get to my notes on him. He basically talks about how we're moving into an ecological age, and and that we must do so. We must do so. He says that humanity is caught in a technological entrancement, and that he says human consciousness is in the narrowest confines it has experienced since consciousness emerged from its Paleolithic phase. The first thing is, he says, we need to explain to ourselves our entrancement with an industrially driven consumer society to break the spell that has seized us. he says, in entering the ecological age, our problems can no more be resolved within our former pattern of the human than the problems that led to quantum physics, or that led to quantum physics, could be dealt with by any adjustment within the content of the Newtonian universe. In other words, what he's talking about is a complete transformation of the way we interact with the Earth. And basically what he's talking about, he goes on to talk about that humanity must have a feeling and a vision that the planet is integral to itself, and that we are part that we are an interdependent part of the planet and the evolutionary process. And he says, without this understanding at a deep level, we will not have the psychic power to undergo the psychic and social transformations that are being demanded of us. The paragraph that I'm trying to describe here is it gets a little I could read through it, but it gets a little it gets a little kind of makes you a little dizzy, but basically it says here, humanity must have a vision of a planet integral with itself throughout its spatial extent and its evolutionary sequence is of primary importance if we are to have the psychic power to undergo the psychic and social transformation that are being demanded of us. And that's pretty close to the Gaia concept that...
I was just going to ask if you want to describe the Gaia concept in James Lovelock.
Right. That's pretty close. He's getting pretty close to the Gaia concept that James Lovelock came up with. And James Lovelock is a scientist who's 92 years old now, and he proposed the Gaia concept, or the Gaia hypothesis, quite some time ago, and it's now called the Gaia theory. And he refers to, he defines Gaia as a, quote, self-sustaining physiological system that has kept our planet habitable for life for over 3 billion years. It appears to have the unconscious goal of regulating the climate and the chemistry at a comfortable state for life. So my understanding is that he feels that the living biosphere interacts with the physical planet, and that those two systems together evolve together. And so I know that's kind of but he does say that you know, we need to, as humans need to learn to love the planet and love nature before we began our love with city life way back when. Without that, we're not going to be able to do what we need to do. I mean, I think I think this really is crucial here because, you know, I've heard a number of people talk about all sorts of, solutions which are pretty far out, you know, like putting a 7-mile disk out in space to cut off a few percent of sunlight and space-based solar arrays, but the reality is that if collectively we cannot understand that the Earth has certain limits and that we need to know what those limits are, we need to define them, and that we need to live creatively within those limits. You know, we're going to destroy the planet. So it's like that will happen sooner or later if we don't come to that fundamental understanding.
You mentioned the second while back about deforestation. So as soon as we need to take our second break, and as soon as we come back, I want to ask you about deforestation.
Okay.
Let's shake off winter and get the new year started off right. Thursday, January 9th at Knucklehead Saloon, the Dead Girls and the Choosy Beggars play two classic albums live, Revolver and Beggar's Banquet. Tickets at www.knuckleheadskc.com. That's Thursday, January 9th. A splendid time is guaranteed for all.
This week on The Bioneers, Revolution from the Heart of Nature.
Ask yourself whether the wounding of the whole earth isn't the same wounding that takes place for us as individuals when we face that kind of loss.
I'm Neil Harvey. Please join us this week when we explore how human health and the health of the earth are intimately linked with our guest Michael Lerner on The Bioneers, Revolution from the Heart of Nature.
Friday morning at 9:30, right after Between the Lines.
Okay, thank you. We are back. David, in regard to, I mentioned deforestation, we've been talking about global warming from the aspect of what we are putting into the atmosphere in terms of pumping carbon into the atmosphere and the effect that has. Now, the forest is normally, I think you mentioned, is the lungs of the earth.
Particularly the rainforest, the Amazon rainforest, the tropical rainforest, they really they kind of act as the lungs of the earth, and we're losing the rainforest at a very rapid rate. You know, this cannot continue, and you know, I think the world needs its forests, and if we continue to destroy them, then we're going to be in real big trouble.
So without the forest taking the carbon out, the forest then is an issue we have to address kind of on the same plane with the same importance as addressing getting rid of the fossil fuels.
Yeah, not only the forest, but the IPCC talks about when they talk about degradation of the environment, they talk about the burning of fossil fuels and secondarily land use changes, you know, in other words, agriculture. Mm-hmm. So you have a significant part of the surface of the world being farmed with monoculture, a lot of industrial farming, and that's, you know, that's land, natural land, possibly forests that would that don't exist because of the farming that we need to do to feed ourselves. So.
Yeah. And when we talk about phasing out fossil fuels and replacing it with renewable energy, we're talking to some extent, aren't we, about the sustainability and population and reducing the carbon per person. But don't we also have to do something about the overall population to reduce that total carbon level?
Well, yeah, population is sort of the 800-pound elephant in the room that doesn't get talked about a whole lot. You know, I think the reality is that since population has increased from... I've got a sheet of paper here. It's increased from, I think in 1930 it was 2 billion. And then I think, and then in 1960 it made it up to 3 billion. And by just very recently we made it up to 7. So it's like, here we go.
And to get to that first 2 billion, we're talking about a few thousand years. And now...
Yeah,
we've more than doubled in less than 100 years.
Yeah, at the time, at zero AD, the time of Christ, 200 million people were on the planet. And it took till 1830 years to get to 1 billion, and then another 100 to get to 2 billion in 1930, and then only 30 years to get to 3 billion in 1960, 2005, 6.45 billion, and then 2011, 7. So, and then projected to be 10.5 in 2050. And with the increase in population, you know, CO2 has correspondingly just gone right up with it, you know. So there cannot be endless growth in population. There cannot be endless growth in I'm going to get myself in trouble here, in economies. I mean, there has to be a fundamental recognition that the whole idea of endless growth has to go. You know, we need to work. We need to work within the limits of the planet, and work with the planet, and recognize that the human race is interdependent with each other. We are all interdependent with each other, and we are all interdependent with the whole biosphere, you know. So definitely, you know, I'm, you know, population gets to be a pretty controversial issue, but I'm not so sure I'm willing to tackle that right now. But it's a population does need to come down. And, you know, the good news is that I know that the birth rate of the world population is coming down, and there are a lot of countries that have gone below 2.0 children per couple, and some are headed that way, but it still is. The world population is not there yet at all.
Okay, and that's all the time we have. Thank you. We do have a couple calendar items. One that I have is on January 14th, which is a Tuesday evening, the Sierra Club over on the Kansas side will have its monthly meeting with a speaker. And for more information and the location and who the speaker is, you can go to www.kansas.sierraclub.org. Thomas Hart Bunton Group also has meetings. You can go to sierraclub.org and click on the chapter in the group to find information on their activities.
A few things, Craig, do we have time?
Okay.
All right. You know, I just, you know, people can go to, you know, the national sites for Citizens Climate Lobby, and there's all sorts of information there, 350.org, Natural Resources Defense Council, Union of Concerned Scientists is a really good organization, Earth Justice Legal Defense Fund, World Resources Institute. Basically, you can just Google environmental organizations, global warming, and you'll get a whole list of organizations that you could possibly join.
All right. Thank you.
And we've got one other calendar event, and this goes through January 26, 2014, Recycle Your Tangled, Broken Holiday Lights. And this is taking place at all Bankability locations in the metropolitan area. So that includes Security Bank on the Kansas side, as well as Industrial Bank and Mission Bank and Valley View Bank and Citizen State Bank in Paola. On the Missouri side, it's First Bank of Missouri and Bank of Lee's Summit. That's through January 26th. There will be a drop-off container at each of those banks, and it's a great way to keep those things out of the landfill. So thanks to everyone for tuning in. This program will be up on a podcast probably tomorrow, and so you can listen to it again if there was a piece of information you want to go back to. Also, next week, because Richard Mabian had other issues last week, next week he's going to do his 2013 in review program on Eco Radio KC. And if you haven't finished getting your green on yet, KDHX, our sister community radio station in St. Louis, starts their local environmental program called Earthworms at 7 o'clock. But, of course, you're free to stay here and listen to Sabor Latino right here on 90.1 FM, KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio.